Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Dignified State of the Union addresses, out. Nikki Haley, out. Kyrsten Sinema, out. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Maddie Kearns, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brennan Doherty, you are, of course, listening to a National U podcast. Our sponsors this episode are the How the World Works podcast from CEI and David Bonson's new book, Full Time. More about both of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So MBD, I was meaning to post this yesterday before the speech, but to my regret, I didn't, because I would have been proved correct. But I just thought the bar for Biden on the speech was so low that there's really no way he wasn't going to pass it. It's all you have to do, basically stand there for an hour, read from the teleprompter a speech you've been practicing for weeks. And he clearly, you know, there's an emphasis on being not just feisty, as I said beforehand, but fiery. Even he shouted his way through most of the speech. Still seemed to me like a very old man who's not really up to this, but you could just look at the glowing faces of the Democratic members of Congress, just delighted that he had crossed the low bar.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extremely low bar. You know, you can tell it's a low bar, you know, just by your own sense of watching it. I mean, I don't know about anyone else, but I had a sick feeling in the half hour leading up to the speech, you know, that something horrible will happen. Like, he will fall, like, one of his limbs will become unstitched from his body and just drop to the floor. You know, like, he just seems, he has seemed so decrepit. And in fact, that's rather the point, right? I think Marco Rubio called it a proof of life speech.
That's pretty good. I like
that. Of course, he can deliver this. He can do this. He can rest and be worked up by his doctors and do this yelling thing. But the fact is, like, that doesn't actually erase all of the other impressions he's made with voters about his infirmity, fundamentally.
Yeah, he reminded me, he's a little bit like when he's in this mode he was in last night, kind of like a chattering skeleton, you know, you see in Halloween, because he's so gaunt, you know, but he's talking and he's yelling, but yeah. Still, he's kind of a skeleton.
And, you know, he had a few little ad-libs that worked, but then there was one section where he started, you know, jawing with Marjorie Taylor Greene about the murder of that poor young woman in Georgia. And he started mangling the details of the immigration bill and losing the plot, right? And losing his ability to read the teleprompter clearly before he restudied himself and recentered himself on the actual text again. So as performance, yeah, he like clears this insanely low bar.
Yeah, well, I think a key thing, Maddie, so MBD, you're right. You know, Bill Clinton was always going for the 70%. You know, what's the 70% issue? How do I get the other 20% with me, or however you want to formulate it? But I think Biden is so freaked out about the worries of his base that this speech was overwhelmingly concerned with reassuring them that, one, he could stand up there and be feisty and take the fight to Trump. And State of the Union addresses aren't what they used to be, and they're never great, you know, even in the heyday. But I found there was something distasteful about just how, frankly, partisan this was. Now, I'm in a different place in Ukraine than MBD is. So I thought he, you know, scored some points at the beginning on Russia and the line. I think it's kind of a killer line. You can't just love your country when you win. I think that's a really telling line. But otherwise, just the deceptions and the lies. And this was an opportunity for him, maybe the last one he'll really have, to, in front of a mass audience of people, to be presidential. And obviously they weren't interested in that. They had a different priority, taking it to Trump and reassuring their base. But the IVF thing, the Alabama Supreme Court banned, you know, IVF in the state. It was so ridiculously off base. And we haven't since Noah guest hosted for me when the IVF ruling came down that week, and I was on vacation, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. So I experienced that story like a normal news consumer. So I heard about it, and I heard like the Supreme Court had done this terrible thing, basically banning IVF. And I thought maybe something like that had actually happened. And then I got home and I was busy with other stuff, and I didn't read our editorial about it until like the next Wednesday. And I was just shocked that this wasn't an anti-IVF ruling. In fact, the opposite. But that's not how it's being portrayed.
Yeah, that section was so dishonest. The Alabama ruling was a straightforward reading of the law, finding that human embryos, were children under the pre-existing wrongful death statute. That there then needed to be some clarity about how this was going to affect the IVF industry. But I think, as we said in our editorial, it was perfectly possible to say, we're not banning IVF. IVF can go ahead, but there needs to be greater respect for these lives, these human embryos, which would be the pro-life position, right? You don't have to ban IVF to take that more seriously, and at the very least insist on regulation. But he's obviously just willing to lie about this, as countless other things, you know, suggesting it was the direct result of the overturning of Roe. He also lied about the Texas case, saying that this woman who had an abortion at, I think, around 20 weeks for her unborn child with trisomy 18 had been denied life-saving care. And again, there's absolutely no evidence that that's true, but he said it anyway. I think that Biden, you're right, it was partisan, it was distasteful. He had a couple of good lines in there. You can't love your country only when you win was one. I think he also had a good line about, they've said I'm too young when I started in politics. Yeah, that was, and that was speech writer gave him a gift with that. He was obviously at the beginning speaking very quickly and amazingly didn't trip up as much as I thought he was going to. I also thought he obviously bungled the name of Lincoln Riley, but yeah, but he, you know, he's called her Lincoln, I think, but some people presented it as he was taking Marjorie Taylor Greene's bait, but I think he actually kind of set her up because he had the last word, obviously.
Yeah. And he was ready for it, right?
He was ready for it. Yeah.
And I thought that the best line going back a week or so ago when we had the dueling border visits, Trump's best line, I thought, was Biden will never mention her name, which I thought was true and very telling. But I mean, he botched her name, but he did try to say her name.
Yeah. So, and then I think, you know, some of our colleagues were pointing out that he was really subpar on Israel and foreign policy. And I think that's true as well. But overall, I have to say I was expecting worse. So at least he got through it. He's got that going for him.
Charlie?
Well, MBD said that he spent the time leading up to the speech worrying that a horrible thing would happen. And it did. Biden gave that speech, which was inappropriate. Now, I accept that it wasn't for me, but I don't think that that is how the President of the United States should behave. The State of the Union should not exist in the first place. It should be a letter. It's a grotesque sight to watch a president, like some king, going into another branch of government to lecture them, chastise them in some cases. I think Thomas Jefferson was right to get rid of it. I think it's telling that it was restored by Woodrow Wilson. But if you're going to do it, don't do that. That was a campaign speech. That was not a State of the Union address. Not in the way that would have been understood by those who wrote those words into the Constitution. And sure, I'm not primed to like it. But I didn't like Trump's either. And I would challenge anyone listening to go back and listen to episodes of The Editors. I don't like any of them. That one was particularly campaigny. and partisan. Joe Biden did not last night act as president of the United States. He acted as a presidential candidate for the Democratic Party, which is fine in most circumstances. That's politics. But last night he was president of the United States.
Yeah, you had literal four more year chance from the floor. So, Charlie, on this point, would you accept, sorry to interrupt, a friend of mine who I checked in with this morning said, you know what this is? It's more like a parliamentary leader than a president. Do you think that's a correct description?
No, I think it's monarchical. I think it smacks of the speech from the throne, which is what Wilson would have wanted it to be. I don't think
you mean the State of the Union in general?
I mean in general. Last night, I don't think it was parliamentary either. No, I think it was a rally in a sense. And look, Republicans behave badly in these things. They have done for years. And Biden knew that. And it's unseemly. And I'm sorry, I'm not a guy who rends my garments and clutches my pearls at politics or speech that is edgy. But this is a civic moment. This is not a National Review podcast or a debate or some guys talking at a football stadium. This is a national civic event in which the president arrives in a House of Representatives chamber by invitation of the speaker as the president of the United States, the one person who is elected by anyone. And I just thought that speech was an angry, hectoring disgrace. And I wish we didn't have it. Now, on the substance, I think Biden's in a really difficult position. He got through it without dying, which was great. But that's about the bare minimum you can give him. He's shouty. He's unintelligible often. He looks really old. He lacks a command of detail. And his presidency has been a failure, as many modern presidencies have. And he can't get past that. And he didn't get past that, in my view. So if the question is, did he do the bare minimum politically? Yeah, he did. If the question is, did he do a good job? No. We need to start choosing better people in this country. I apply that just as much to the Republican Party as to the Democrats. That is not what we should want from our leaders in any sense. And the fact that he's old makes it worse, but it's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is that we've lost sight of something, and that was another example of it.
So, MBD, what did you think of the Middle East discussion and this idea of this floating pier?
I thought it was remarkable. I have been saying for some time now, and I'll say it again, I think the cascade of opinion on the left against Israel is one of the most significant political developments of the year and maybe of the decade. And I think it was reflected in this speech, which was had a shocking amount of criticism of Israel in it for a U.S. president who initially rhetorically backed Israel to the hilt, right? And he invoked that history.
The most criticism of Israel, harshest criticism of Israel ever in a State of the Union address, right? But that's another thing where there's a very low bar, I assume.
It's a very low bar, but he had a lot of it. And I was surprised. And he did it even while invoking, you know, his previous support. You know, I'm the only president who's been visited in wartime. Now, the idea of building that the U.S. is building a pier in Gaza to deliver humanitarian aid is so insane to me. I have trouble expressing the words. It reminds me of the idiotic intervention in Mogadishu in the 90s, which also began as an offshore humanitarian thing that was then, you know, expanded to do one more thing and one more thing and one more thing until our soldiers started getting killed. It is, you know, the military literature on building this a pier like this in a hostile zone, it requires some boots on the ground ashore. If that's going to be the IDF, I cannot imagine they want to dedicate manpower to this sort of a mission.
Yeah, well, that's one way these things expand, right? You need to protect your people. So to protect the people, you need more people.
Right. And then further, it's just, I can't imagine anything politically worse, both for the United States and for Israel, than further entanglement in this conflict. I mean, both sides benefit from disentangling. Israel gets more freedom of action, and the United States gets more freedom from the universal hatred which greets Israel's every waking breath, which is a thing that defies all political explanation and begs for the supernatural. So I think this is nuts and outrageous, and it's an insanely risky way to try to appease this slice of the base. Right now, John Fetterman is plus 20 on Biden in Pennsylvania, a swing state, and all John Fetterman is doing is viciously dunking on people that wave Palestinian flags in his face, and also needling transgender activists. So by running to the middle, John Fetterman is surging politically in a swing state. Now Biden is going to try to win the election off the coast of Gaza? Are you kidding me? Who's advising him? The people that are criticizing Joe Biden as Genocide Joe, they don't care about putting a little port in Gaza and sprinkling more humanitarian aid on it. They want Joe Biden to force the Israelis into a ceasefire, or they want him to abandon Israel altogether. And that's the only thing that will satisfy them. This will do nothing to appease them, but it could do a lot to put our troops in danger or embroil us in a region that is third rate and a mess.
Yeah. So, Maddie, let's talk a little bit about the response. As we always have to preface the discussion of a response, it's not an easy assignment. Katie Britt, up and coming senator from Alabama, delivered the response. She did it from her kitchen, which would seem, you know, a good idea in theory. Not sure this worked. One, the delivery was just, it felt as though she was a third grade teacher reading a book to her students. I think most of the things she said were fine, but questionable, as we were discussing before we started recording, this really graphic story she used of this young woman who was trafficked and abused in the most horrific manner by the cartels. What did you make of her performance last night?
Yeah, I think the inclusion of that story was inappropriate. I think that it was, the delivery was unbelievably mawkish and hammy, so much so that it distracted from the content. There was sort of inappropriate smiling when she was talking about serious things. There was breathtaking. After the word breathtaking, she'd take like deep, dramatic breath. There was like a great deal of emotional range in a very short space of time. So going from happy and sort of on the verge of laughter to really angry and serious. It was a mess. I mean, it's just the sort of thing that, as Michael said before we started recording, that you can just see this becoming an SNL skit. And it's hard to blame them because it was just really over the top. And as Michael was saying about who is advising Biden to do something so self-defeating, I kind of felt the same thing. I was like, did she not practice this in front of people? Maybe her husband.
She did a lot. She did a lot, right?
And did somebody not say, you know, I think you're kind of overdoing it. I would maybe tone it down by like.
Yeah, who's the guy's coming? Katie, more emotion. We need more emotion.
I mean, it was. I mean, it's the sort of thing that, like, look, if you're on a TED, you're giving a TED talk, you're on a stage, you know, you're trying to, the cameras are far away, you're trying to project your voice, you can get away with a bit more, but this is a cool format. You need to be more moderate, you need to be more temperate and in your tone. And I was not impressed.
Yeah. So the record stands that the only Republican who's given a good, or maybe the only person who's given a good response was Fred Thompson way back in 1995, sitting on his Senate desk. But he was a genuine actor, so he was really good at it. Exit question to you, Charlie Cook. Letter grade for Joe Biden's State of the Union address.
I'd give him a D. I don't like the format. I don't like what he said. I don't like how he said it. But he did the minimal thing that he was expected to do, which was make it through without leaving in a box.
There was a moment when he was getting off. I thought that was one of the perilous moments. Would he know how to get down? And he did mostly, but there's clearly, you could tell, even though you couldn't see it from the camera angle, there was one more step, but he was standing on that step and began talking to people. And you're like, oh no, is he going to forget that step is there? And there was a guy who's kind of helping him guide him along, and he negotiated it successfully. Letter grade, MBD.
I'm going to give him a C+. Just in the sense of he really needed to not put Democrats into further panic about mm-hmm. him. And that's how they feel. And he did it by giving a very partisan speech. And it's something they desire. It's something that they tell themselves that they want from their presidents, is more partisanship and really take it to Republicans like the way Republicans take it to them. And so for that alone, I think he did himself a favor. So, yeah. But otherwise, though, I just want to emphasize, I totally agree with Charlie. I found the whole spectacle ugly. And, like, I just wish the future House leader would not invite the president to do mm-hmm. this.
Yeah. Maddie, we have a D and a C+.
I'm actually going to give him a B-.
Took my grade. Yeah.
I was going to say, by the time we get to Rich, it'll be an A.
Yeah, I have to bump it up now.
I thought it was very partisan, far too partisan for my taste. And it was huge sections of it which were just completely dishonest, as we'd expect. But in terms of actual delivery, and then in terms of the politics of it, and then, you know, I think his speechwriters gave him a few, as I say, really memorable lines. I think it was, from his perspective and from Democrats' perspective, it was probably quite good.
Yeah, I agree with everything Maddie said. I mean, I won't repeat everyone else said about what was bad about it, but the theory of what they need to do politically, reassure Democrats, bring some Democrats home, maybe they need to do that, you know? And it was a distasteful spectacle, but I think they achieved what they wanted to. They achieved their political goal, and their political goal was not crazy. So with that, let's hear from our first sponsor this episode. Our friends at the Competitive Enterprise Institute are back with new episodes of their breakout How the World Works podcast, hosted by author and political commentator Kevin Williamson. If you're not already listening to the show, each episode, Kevin sits down with notable guests for candid conversations about the jobs they've had and the role of work in the economy and our social lives. From flipping burgers and tending pigs on a farm to leading special ops missions in far corners of the globe, some of America's best thinkers discuss the jobs they've had that informed their outlook on life and future careers. In a recent episode, Kevin sat down with Jonah Goldberg, both of whom are old friends and colleagues of National Review, of course, for a fascinating conversation about the ins and outs of Jonah's decades-long career in the media. So be sure to listen to How the World Works wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit cei.org/howtheworldworks. That's cei.org/howtheworldworks. Please check it out. So speaking of checking out, see how I did that, Maddie? That's I'm proud of that one. So Nikki Haley out of the race. I was wrong. I thought she'd end up exiting before South Carolina. She stayed in, maybe overperformed a little bit in South Carolina, got 40%. But as the political calendar accelerated and she had less time to campaign in states that were also less favorable to her inherently than New Hampshire and South Carolina, her vote began to get closer to her national polling. Not really down there. She's been polling at 15% against Trump nationally, but, you know, more like 25, 30. And it was just clear, you know, this wasn't happening. And it was already a little bit ridiculous. You know, every interview when you're trailing this badly, they ask you, why are you still in the race? And she, you know, the energy is incredible. We just had this big crowd in Virginia. And it was obviously unsustainable to keep doing that. And she dropped out with a very welcome, short and pointed exit speech. What did you make of it?
Yeah. So, you know, in a way, you have to hand it to her. Few of us predicted that she'd be in the final matchup with Trump, but she did a lot better than we expected at the beginning. You know, she'd started out with less money than Ron DeSantis, with less sort of public support and momentum than DeSantis, but she kind of held it as long as she possibly could. But as you say, once you it's absolutely obvious you have no path to the nomination, you just run into that "what are you doing" question. And she obviously picked up support in Vermont and DC, but these aren't exactly Republican strongholds. And it comes back to the point that actually, I think it was Steve Kornacki made, where he said, look, there's a difference between people who vote in Republican primaries and Republican voters. And one of Trump's key lines of attack on Haley was that it's not Republicans who are supporting her. And that does raise a big question now, though, which is like, where do her supporters go? Do they go to Trump or do they go to Biden? Trump doesn't seem particularly interested in trying to win them over. You saw that with Haley's speech. She said, you know, it's now on Trump to do this, to bring people into his cause. Biden's all too happy to have them, but he's not willing to make the sort of concessions that would attract moderates and independents. But yeah, I mean, Haley had a much better run than we thought she'd have. You know, she obviously stuck to her principles in terms of unpopular positions like Ukraine. And even she took a kind of nuanced view of the IVF thing as well, and said her own opinion is that the embryos should be considered people, which wasn't, you know, isn't particularly popular. So I do have respect for her in that sense. But yeah, I'm not sure where her voters go. It's my main takeaway.
Yeah, and spending. I mean, she talked about spending and the debt a lot, which is not in fashion anymore with the Republican Party. So, Charlie, what did you think of you know, the final weeks here? She was clearly holding up the banner for a kind of Republicanism that I think in theory is better than Trump's, if you could convince a majority of the party of that again. And her criticisms of Trump got harsher and harsher. You know, the less chance she had of winning, not that she ever had really much of a chance of winning, the harsher she got. She began to sound like Chris Christie. And this obviously wasn't going to work, but, you know, there's a place in politics for just standing up for key tenets that you believe, even if you're not going to convince 50 plus one of them.
Well, I think the rationale behind her candidacy changed in that at the beginning, there was presumably a hope that she could attract so many people that she would become the nominee. And she, although she talked about entitlements and had a different foreign policy than Trump and most of the other candidates, she largely shied away from going for Trump's jugular because, correctly, she assumed that anyone who's going to beat Trump's going to need to bring his voters with them. Unfortunately, no one did that. And by the end, she therefore had a different role to play, which was to try to get as many people who really didn't want Trump as possible. And the way that you do that is you go after Trump in terms you wouldn't if you thought you were going to win. So really, there were two campaigns. I read that piece in, I think it was Politico, that suggested she ran a perfect campaign but for Trump. Well, okay. But that is the whole game. And it's like saying I pitched perfectly except against Aaron Judge. That's not actually going to win you the game. So I think she did much better than I thought she would at the beginning. But by the end, she was running the not Trump campaign and also probably doing so without much hope that she's going to have a future. I mean, she probably thinks that she is in her quiet moments because everyone who gets that close, as it were, thinks that. But unlike some other figures who really could be president in different circumstances, I think she likely let it go a little bit because she knew that it's not as if they'll be clamoring for her in 2028.
Yeah. So MBD, what's your big takeaway? I wouldn't call myself a 2004 Republican, but I'm more of a 2004 Republican than you are. And she really ran as a 2004 Republican. And even though there's a lot of that, you know, I agree with and admire, there's just something about it. I can't quite even put my finger on it. That sort of rubbed even me the wrong way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's because it's no longer 2004, and there is this, people who have hung on to the true faith of the, you know, high George W. Bush era have a different relationship with Republican voters now, you know, and have had since 2006, and especially since 2016. And so there's this edge of, I'm trying to save it, the edge is much more explicit of like, I'm trying to save my party from the troglodytes and the America Firsters and the organic supplement people and the non-traditional deodorant people or whatever it is that she, you know, is trying to save the party
organic
from.
Supplement people.
And Joe Rogan.
Alex Jones. Alex Jones. Okay, so anyone like mass media that's pitching that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, I think, you know, there's that edge to that politics. And along with that also is implied a continuing faith in, you know, like Victoria Nuland and Applebaum style, like the foreign policy blob. And people just have moved on. It's been 20 years and there's been, you know, things have been said in this marriage that can't be unsaid. and so that's, I think that's why it comes across as different. I will say though, that she also spoke to a slightly different constituency, I think. And I think the thing that will have some staying power in the party, and it's something that's stalked everyone, is that there is always in a conservative party, a voice for, well, the whole culture is moving left. We have to moderate a little bit. Like, we have to be a modern party. We can't be.
So she did that on abortion and right. I mean, but does she do that on other things?
I don't think so. Well, I mean, actually, you know,
so we're talking about David Cameron impulse.
Yeah, I just think that's always in a conservative party, and it's a constant temptation, and it's. And it also, like,
the autopsy was totally that after 2012.
Of course, yes. So, you know, I think that will remain with us. And in fact, like, you're seeing, you know, some of there's like cultural fissures in the Republican Party between, you know, one friend used to call it the social conservatives versus the barstool conservatives or like the South Park conservatives, you know, but the people that basically like, we're just comfortable in there's a lot of people who were comfortable in the cultural dispensation between the sexual revolution and the woke revolution. And they're increasingly bunched up on the right with, you know, real reactionaries and social cons and people who read papal encyclicals for fun. And it's an odd mix, right? Like, that's going to push the party in different directions in the future too.
So Charlie, a exit question first to you, another repeat exit question. I asked it, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, but it's more relevant given how Nikki handled her exit. Will she endorse Donald Trump? Yes or no?
I think she will. I think she'll find a way to convince herself that he's reached out to her voters and say that out loud. Yeah.
Yes, although I think if he keeps dumping on her, she's going to be disinclined to. So I think maybe
it's going to make it any easier for her, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. If there's some sort of like gesture of goodwill from Trump, I think yes.
MBD.
Yeah, she'll endorse, but she might do it in the way that like Ron DeSantis did, where like it was followed up within the same week with like criticism as well. In a way that will publicly and permanently define her as out for the next administration and, you know, separate from whatever defeat might await him either this year or to come.
Yeah. I think she just should have endorsed him in her exit speech. Done it like DeSantis, do it quickly, do it dignified. Don't do it in a fulsome way. Certainly don't do it in the Tim Scott, you know, I'm standing behind you with pom poms at your rally, humiliating fashion. But I think she's created a little bit of a box canyon for herself, because what is really Trump going to do? You know, is he really going to change his tone or change his substance or reach out to her voters? Now there's some question. I think the answer is no. Does she really have voters? And that sounds like they're Bernie Sanders voters, the way a leader of a movement has voters. I don't think she does, but at the very least, Trump should be very concerned about holding as many of these people as he can and kind of sending a signal to at least some of them by being, you know, decent and showing some grace towards Nikki Haley, which he hasn't managed yet and maybe won't at all. But I think she'll have to find a way. She will find a way to endorse one way or the other. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor this episode. It is deep in the ethos of National Review that work is a bedrock in a flourishing society, and that work is a pivotal component in the God-given dignity of every person. Economist and financial manager David Bahnsen, our friend and colleague, has taken this message to its full potential with his brand new book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life. Whether it be in public policy, in the culture, or even in the church, too often work is seen as a necessary evil and not the universal blessing that it is. David argues in his brand new book for the economic, theological, and ontological significance of work, suggesting that it's core to our identity and that the fastest way to a failed state will be to continue in this low regard for work that ignores our God-given capacity for productivity. David does not shy away from defending work as a therapeutic, cathartic vehicle for dealing with challenging circumstances in life, and ultimately argues that the other things we value in a well-ordered life, marriage, children, community worship, are all enhanced when we properly prioritize and centralize work. It is not a book on work that you've ever read before. Get David Bahnsen's Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life today at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever fine books are sold. That's Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. And check out more at fulltimebook.com. It's a powerful and fascinating argument that David makes in this book, and I urge you to check it out. So speaking of checking out, I'm going to do it yet again. Charlie, Kyrsten Sinema out of the Senate race in Arizona. She had decided, well, you know, I don't think I'm going to win a Democratic primary, and I'm going to get primaried because I haven't gotten on board, or at least not very, very quickly on board some of these Biden spending initiatives. So I'm going to go my own way. I'm going to be an independent. I'm going to win some Democrats, win some Republicans, win some independents, and make this thing happen. But it was clear that it wasn't happening, and Sinema said she is out of the race and made a fairly despairing statement pointing to how our political culture is broken. What did you make of it?
I am saddened by it. Not because I agree with Kyrsten Sinema on everything, I certainly don't, but because I think that she did a lot of good for our political system. She acted in the Senate as you might expect someone who is a Democrat who won in Arizona, and did so not because Arizona has at least yet moved hardly to the left, but because the Republicans were crazy. She showed a great deal of respect for the institution of the Senate and was instrumental in maintaining one of its key features, the filibuster, and understanding why. Her arguments, which were roundly criticized by progressives, were correct. They were, in a sense, a reflection of that understanding of her role in Arizona. She grasped that, especially in a time of polarization, you want to have a Congress that only acts with broad-based buy-in. That insofar as we have profound political differences in this country, and we do, when Congress demurs, the states step in, and that is a better venue for the manifestation of our disagreements. She also, unlike Joe Manchin, has a set of political preferences to which she hews quite closely. She is, on social issues, an out-and-out new-style liberal. She is pro-choice. She's pro-gay marriage. But she's not in favor of tax increases and tinkering with the economy from the center. And this confuses people because we like to push everyone into ideologically consistent boxes. or at least to bring them into line with the prevailing two parties. But she didn't really fit. And I think by becoming an independent, she destroyed her own career, but she made that point quite well. And she also highlighted that we don't do too well at the moment with maverick senators. And she is not going to be reelected. She's not going to be president of the United States. She's not going to be governor of Arizona. She is probably finished. And she's finished because for all the talk in America of the center not holding or a desire for less partisanship, the two parties remain powerful. People remain attached to them. And there's no place for her in that system. Again, I don't lament that she didn't get her own way on a whole bunch of policies. I am a conservative who thinks Arizona ought to have a Doug Ducey-style politician in every office. But I was impressed by her for being honest, for understanding her role, and for living it out in such a way that forced her eventually to sacrifice her own career.
Yeah, so MBD, she was clearly working off some version of the John McCain model. You know, that's how to thrive in Arizona and be there for a long time in the Senate is to be a maverick. And it worked for McCain, who, God knows, had a lot of Republican critics, but became enough of an institution and had enough appeal to the middle that it worked for him. And it clearly wasn't going to work for Sinema.
Yeah, and I think it wouldn't have kept working for McCain.
I agree.
Into this decade. And I actually think that's the lesson that we just learned from Sinema, because I also thought, oh, she's going to slip into this role now that the Republicans in Arizona have gone crazy. Mm-hmm. But then when the internal politics of the Democratic Party made themselves so evident, it just showed that, in fact, statewide candidates for both parties cannot consistently buck the base and expect to remain.
So this is because the bases are just more influential and powerful now, or more polarized. I kind of hate that cliche.
I think they're more influential and powerful now, and they're connected to national networks of action that can.
So that just makes it harder to establish like an independent identity, separated from those bases, the way McCain did, and a lot of people did prior to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the last one you're seeing now is Romney, who has a special relationship to Utah, and Utah has a special relationship to the rest of the country. That I think that's it. You know, and then elsewhere, you know, senators that buck things, you know, like a J.D. Vance, it's just going to be so in line with their region and that region's interests, and not necessarily a sign of their total, you know, creativity or, you know, sui generis of appeal. You know, the Kyrsten Sinema story was a funny one in the long stretch of it. Is she began as like a Gen X activist person, right? She was a Gen X activist, and she's kind of finishing up as someone who was not only made herself an institutionalist in the Senate, but also like seems to have a very, you know, I would almost say, I don't know if it's wizened or cynical view of politics, but a view of politics where...
Yeah, she was chased into bathrooms by the kind of activist she used to be.
Exactly.
I don't know anything. I mean, I imagine she was not that uncivil, but...
Exactly. But she wasn't embarrassed by the... I don't think she was embarrassed by the... I think she's very interesting in that she seems also not to be embarrassed by the fact that, yes, you know, politicians get stuff done by working with really intelligent lobbyists from K Street who know the issues backwards and forwards. And yes, they're working on their clients' interests too.
Yeah. And if I could just add something as a Sinema watcher, one of the things that marked her out, even when she was a much more radical Code Pink style activist, was that she did believe at the time in the power of power. She wasn't purely in it for the spectacle. She got things done when she was a politician at the state level, and even before that, when she was putting pressure on politicians at the state level. And that taught her to value the process and not merely to enjoy being on the outside throwing rocks in. So I'm not sure she would have chased anyone into a bathroom.
So we get to Maddie in just a second, but MBD, one last thing. Say Romney is kind of the last model of this. Is Fetterman potentially a model? That's kind of in a different way. It's not as though he's sitting down with Republicans working on legislation. That's not the form his independence streak is taking. And instead, it's this very theatrical rejection of the extremes on the left. But would he not be vulnerable to a primary?
I don't know. I mean, I just think the Democrats tend to be hang out too much to the left of their actual party. And what John Fetterman is doing is just being very visibly much more in the center on a few key issues. And it's really working to his benefit. It also helps him that for right now, the Republican Party in Pennsylvania also has an identity crisis, and you know there's political space for him to occupy.
So, Maddie, I endorse everything Charlie said in terms of she was a good senator. You know, I didn't agree with her really on much, and her moderation consisted of just like let's not entirely, but a lot. Let's just get this $4 trillion bill down to $3 trillion or whatever. But she was clearly thoughtful, and she there were certain things she believed about policy very very deeply, and she thought about them seriously, and you just have to admire that.
Yeah, she is scrupulous and has her limits. So while she was supportive of Biden's COVID relief package, she was not supportive of the Build Back Better. The number $3.5 trillion was just too much for her. She obviously, as you've mentioned, has strong respect for institutions against court packing or refusing to just blow up the filibuster. I am concerned, honestly, about the filibuster, what with her leaving, Mitch McConnell leaving, Joe Manchin leaving. You know, that this is something that could really transform the Senate for the worse. And it's not, the threat to this doesn't just come from Democrats, of course. There's also a populist theory that that the state can be used for right-wing causes as well. Donald Trump, I think, at one point even said he was interested in this potential. And this is the test in what's going to happen in Arizona, because you're going to have the presumptive Democratic nominee, I think Ruben Gallego, who supports quote unquote filibuster reform, and then obviously the Republican front runner Carrie Lake. I don't know where she stands on this off the top of my head, but
she stands wherever Donald Trump stands, and she's probably vacuuming the floor before he got there.
So things could get pretty nuclear, and it's sad that Kirsten Sinema type, the sort of from a Republican perspective, the sort of reliably unreliable for Democrats politician, is becoming a rarer breed, or at least finding it more difficult to survive in the Senate.
So, Charlie, I ask a question to you: Carrie Lake will be the next senator from Arizona? Yes or no?
No.
MBD?
No.
Maddie?
Yeah, I think the Democrat's going to win.
She will not be the next senator from Arizona, so I'll make it unanimous with that. Let me do a quick plug for NR Plus, digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. Your way around a meter paywall, your way. If you sign up and log in, see about 90% fewer ads. Your way. If you want to, you don't have to comment on articles and blog posts and get invited to exclusive events and calls with our writers, editors, and other conservative figures. Plus, most importantly, it's a really crucial way to support our valuable journalism. We don't need people to pay a lot for it. We do need people to pay something for it. So if you are not already a member of NR Plus, please consider joining tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as a member today, tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, if you really want to procrastinate. So let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you were anticipating a visit from your father.
Yeah, in fact, actually, as we're recording, I think he's touching down in Newark Airport right now. Just haven't seen my father in a bit. And there's a whole huge big backstory between him and me, which you can buy in the remainder bin somewhere. It's called My Father Left Me Ireland. And it's just great that he's coming over to visit the grandkids and have a sweet weekend together.
So, Maddie, you went to the opera?
I did, yeah. My husband and I went to go see Romeo and Juliet, and we were sitting in the family circle, which is the affordable section. But it's quite funny because it's, you know, I thought like, well, family circle will be a bit more relaxed, but people still take it very seriously. In fact, I kept hearing somebody shushing somebody else. And actually, I couldn't hear the person they were shushing. So I felt like turning around and shushing the shusher. But then that would be really annoying to the people near me. So I didn't do that. But it was great.
That would have been so meta of you.
Yeah.
So my wife is a big opera person. So I've seen a fair number of operas in my time. And I it's a great art form, but I can't truly... I'm just not that into it. But my MO, I'd pay attention for about the first hour fairly closely. And that's really all I could bear. And then I would just close my eyes. And the music's nice and kind of doze off. And it ended sooner that way. Charlie.
Well, I was in New York with you, in fact, for an NRI event on the Constitution. And I got to do a panel with Alan Gelzo. He was a great historian. The Civil War era, especially of Abraham Lincoln. There was, in fact, at the end of the room in New York, a giant portrait of Lincoln watching us as we spoke. So I felt very responsible for the content. But it was an absolute pleasure to be there, and it was great to meet him. Obviously, I've been reading him for a long time, including in the pages of National Review.
Yeah, it was a great event. You were great, Charlie, the great Heather McDonald, Father Sirico, And Alan is just, I mean, he is a giant. Every time I talk to him, I check in with him periodically. Some question of history comes up and I'll consult him and I'll ask, you know, what are you up to? What are you working on? And it's always, he's not just working on a book. It's always like literally two or three books. He's so incredibly prolific and on top of it. So genuinely wise. With that, it's time for editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick, well, flattering you, Rich, the correct morality behind Biden's open border policy. This is a point I think we've both been hammering in the last year, that Democrats have convinced themselves that this incredible neglect of the border and our laws is somehow the moral thing to do, even if it leads to obvious moral enormities in itself. And it's crazy. It's a kind of sickness that I think Charles Dickens would have instantly recognized and diagnosed.
Thank you, Michael. Maddie, what's your pick?
My pick is Jack Butler's piece, France's Abortion Vote is Another Revolution. I highly recommend it.
Charlie?
Well, I am going to pick Armand White reviewing an Adam Sandler movie. I mean, what can you say about that combo? He excels when he's not looking at a highbrow piece of art. He excels when he's writing about something that is quotidian. And he has such an unusual eye. And I almost always disagree with him, but I love it when instead of reviewing, you know, art movies, he says, oh, well, one of the greatest movies in recent years was Sonic the Hedgehog 2 or something. And you think, well, how could you possibly believe this? Well, this is not, it seems, the usual review of an Adam Sandler movie. He likes this one, and he makes a compelling case in favor of it, and he makes me want to see it.
So I meant to mention, by the way, when we're mentioning our light items, that I've been listening to The Rest of History, a podcast that MBD mentioned a couple of weeks ago. MBD mentioned he had listened to the Nazi series that these two historians, Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook, is that the other guy's name? And it is really stunningly good. And I've listened to a lot of other episodes now. And I think at the beginning, as far as I can tell, they used to have on guests, and now they just talk among the two of them. They just read up on the topic, and they're both really, really good. My pick is Charlie's piece on just the stakes for both Biden and Trump, who risk kicking away their legacies. Biden, the main thing is defeating Trump, stopping Trump. You know, that's his main calling card and accomplishment in 2020. And as we've discussed, easily could be reversed this time around. And same thing with Trump. If he loses again, then you know, everything he did as president begins to wash away, including the Supreme Court. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by a substitute producer who's almost as good as Sarah Schutte, who's away today. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to How the World Works in Full Time. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.